For the benefit of those who are not present in lecture today, if you have not already emailed me and are needing or wanting to do a section swap, please do email me so that I can try to match up people over the weekend. I have gotten several emails, but just in case, if you hadn't sent one to me yet, please do go ahead and send one to me. We started carboxylic acids on Monday, and I think we ended the lecture with Fischer esterification. So let's see that de-esterification, because I want to show that it is exactly the same mechanism, but in reverse. Now, since we have just a short bit of time to do so, before my voice gives out again, let's talk about nomenclature. So, in an ester, you have the alkyl group, and you have the main carboxylic acid itself. The way that an ester name is made is that alkyl group by itself. And then you have the carboxylic acid name that you add an 8 ending to. So you might remember back in General Chem where you had something like nitric acid, that the anion you made from it was called nitrate. Sulfuric, sulfate. Okay, so that's irregular, but still. Acetate. So same thing here. We could use the common name and call this propyl acetate. But that is the common name. It's blurry, isn't it? Hold on. There, that's a little better. The purple is for propyl, and then the blue is for acetate over there. Yes. When I scan it and post it, they'll look better. This, I forget that this particular projector doesn't work all that well. But the systematic name for this is ethanoate, which comes from ethanoic acid. So notice that you take the number part of the term. There's something going on with, we don't have much real estate being displayed, do we? Let me try something here. This one doesn't let you do it. Okay, I'll just have to remember that. So you have the numeric part of the term, methane without the E, ethane, propane, butane, and you add oic acid. So, methanoic, ethanoic, propanoic, butanoic. I'm going to generally use the systematic terms, but so many carboxylic acids have common names. If you look in the back of your shampoo bottles, all these different laurates and laureths, long names, many of those are actually the names, common names, for carboxylic acids. So I'm not going to have you memorize a bunch now. I might over time. The only ones I want you to know for now, the common names, are acetic acid for ethanoic acid, and then formic acid is the common name for methanoic acid. Let me break just for a second. One second, be right back. it's only when I start to try to talk that all of a sudden everything starts to drain at the same time. So, what I was trying to get to is that de-esterification, where I'm going to use ethyl acetate. Very, very common lab solvent, and it's going to be my default compound to use just because it's a small compound to write. Now, the formation of the ester was a reversible reaction, which I probably didn't play up very much on Monday when I talked about it, but it is fully reversible. And in fact, we'll talk in a moment about what's normally done to favor the formation of an ester, because energy-wise, carboxylic acids and esters, they're very, very close to each other in energy. So there's no huge driving force to convert one to the other. So in this case, we would have acid and water, and we would reflux it. Oh, but before we get to that, Hero, yeah. Why is it that it's the carbonyl oxygen and not this oxygen that gets protonated? There is delocalization possible if you protonate on the carbonyl oxygen. If you protonate on the other oxygen, that's all that happens. So you already saw that protonate open attack, so on and so forth, happens by protonating on the carbonyl. If you protonate here, it can and will get protonated, but nothing useful happens. Because there isn't a lone pair even next door to do any resonance with. And this oxygen with its remaining lone pair could delocalize with the carbonyl, but that would make a doubly positively charged oxygen, which is totally unfavorable. So our first question and answer went successfully. The question was on Monday, why is it that it's the carbonyl that prefers to be protonated? And the answer is because the other one, the cation that would be produced, can't be stabilized. So that's a reminder, though, that the in the forward direction, making the ester, it's protonate, open attack, deprotonate. It turns out that's the same sequence of events that happens in reverse, because if you look back at that forward mechanism, the very last step is for the deprotonation of a carbonyl, which means going in reverse, it is going to be the carbonyl that gets protonated first. And that's our principle of microscopic reversibility coming back, that whatever the most energetically favorable pathway of a reaction in the forward direction is automatically, step by step, the same pathway that would be the most energetically favorable in the reverse direction. So protonate. And I am going to again say that for this particular reaction, you do need to use reversible arrows, because it's entirely important that the reaction is fully reversible. So based on the way I did the other day, we now have an open step. In this case, the carbonyl opening. It is water that we're using now. Dessert time. And so water will be the thing that attacks. Which will make an oxonium ion, which will then deprotonate. train.
Oh dear.
And so there's our deprotonate. Does anyone happen to know what an intermediate like this is called? Well, tetrahedral, yes, because you've got four things attached to the central carbon, but functional group-wise. What's that? Not exactly, because an acetal would come from an aldehyde, and this comes from a carboxylic acid instead. I don't remember what the name of something like this is offhand, but I know there are names for it. Maybe if we all look over the weekend in our textbook or Wikipedia, we could come up with the name for this functional group. Maybe that's our next question. Okay. But this is only halfway there, which is the reason I'm pointing it out. And I think I made this comment the other day on Monday, but I'll do it again here, where we have three oxygens that could potentially react. And the question often comes up, well, which one is it that's going to be the one that reacts? The answer is all three of them. If it is one of the oxygens from the OH groups that reacts, then that is going to take us back where we came from. And so the reaction would keep going back and forth and back and forth until eventually the portion that looks like an ether, until that gets protonated. That will move us from our current perspective in the forward direction. So that'll get protonated. It'll leave. Let me more carefully draw that. That's the bond leaving. Now, in this case, just to be able to use that same acronym for protonate open, attack the protonate, I call it attack, but it's really just the drawing of a resonance structure. So if you wanted to put it that way, an intramolecular attack. Followed by a deprotonation. So questions about the mechanism. Probably looks fairly straightforward and should be recognizable since it's similar to the ketal-acetal mechanism of last quarter. So let's talk about favoring equilibrium, which if I felt like it, we could have a long discussion about delta G right now and reaction progress diagrams and draw a bunch of graphs, but let's just keep this simple. What are the definitions of equilibrium? Those of you who are programmed to say it the way that you've learned it from me. Forgot. Okay, the rate of the forward and reverse reactions are equal. No observable energy change. Because you're at the lowest point of energy. And no observable change in the concentrations of reactants and products. It's not that the reactants and products have the same concentration, it's that it's static. Now, Le Chatelier's principle says that you mess with the reaction somehow. Let's say, for example, that we pull out products. If we pulled out products, then the forward reaction is still going at whatever rate it was going, but all of a sudden reverse reaction rate has dropped. So overall, you're going to make more products because you remove products. Energetically, if you remove products, you're changing the energy balance and automatically makes it such that you've pushed the reactants higher in energy again, which means they'll react to make more products until, again, you've made more products. So in other words, whatever way that you stress the system, in this case by pulling products out, the system responds to regenerate that balance, to make more products in this case, to make more of a reverse reaction, to again balance the forward reaction that was not affected by removing the products. But if we're trying to affect the balance of a reaction, then what if we kept removing the products continuously? Then the reaction position is constantly chasing the end, constantly trying to make more products, trying to establish that reverse reaction that never comes because you keep on removing the products. Does anybody remember the piece of glassware, the name of it, that I described last quarter that is often used to do exactly this? Yeah. That's what it is. A Dean Stark trap. And so classic type of esterification you might do is such. Whatever carboxylic acid you might choose, which what would be the systematic name of this one? Butanoic acid. Also called butyric acid from butter. It smells like bad butter. If we wanted to esterify it, we usually use a large excess of the alcohol involved. Because one way to favor products is by throwing in a whole bunch of some kind of reactant. So we flood the reaction. Remember that during esterification, water is going to come off, and water can compete to do the reverse reaction. Of course, the Dean Stark apparatus I'm about to re-describe takes care of water and helps push the reaction, or pull the reaction forward, you could say. But flooding it with the alcohol doesn't hurt. We have our acid catalyst, which we all know the story of tosic acid by now, right? If not, then I guess we have to have another birthday cake with it on it. Then, toluene. Why? Because toluene makes an azeotrope with water, meaning it's two things that normally would not be soluble in each other, but they end up forming a mixture in the vapor phase. And so what that does is it helps remove water from the system. And the end product here is going to be your ester. Now let me draw that Dean Stark apparatus. Give me a moment to do so. So let's say that this is your pear or round bottom flask that we got at the bottom. This is a reflux condenser, up here at least, that you've got attached to Dean Stark. And so you're heating your reaction mixture at the bottom here. If you're heating the reflux, that means you're heating enough to evaporate, to boils. That condenses on the sides of that channel and flows back down. But some of it will automatically flow to the side in this Dean Stark trap. And what happens there, if you blow up on it, is that inside the water is heavier, the toluene and ethanol and everything else mixed together is lighter, and so it's on top. And over time, more water that collects, it pushes that organic layer back up until the point where, depending on the quantities involved, that organic layer spills back over in the reaction mixture. Which means if there was any incomplete reaction that occurred, it's being pushed back over while the water is being removed. You can drain the water out a little bit over time, and so that prevents the water from re-entering the system. It therefore does not allow equilibrium because water can't participate in the reverse reaction, and so the reaction only has the ability to go forward. And then this is assisted because toluene is helping pull the water out because it makes that azeotrope. So even though water's boiling point is much higher than the boiling point of this reaction, it's still pulled out of solution. So the Dean start, I didn't write that down because we did, for those new students, we did discuss it last quarter. So it should be in last quarter's notes that are still available online. We did not talk about the azeotrope of toluene, though, so let me write that part of it out. So toluene forms an azeotrope with water, which is a vapor mixture of two more compounds that would be mutually insoluble. So I guess it would say, you could say would be immiscible in the liquid phase. It is used in Fischer esterifications to help pull water out while a reaction is refluxing. Now, a couple of practical issues. And I won't answer these questions yet. I guess since it's the weekend and you have a little more time to think.
About the assist.
Yes.
Is that a dead end for the side branch?
Yes. No, it usually, in fact, what you'll have is some kind of valve. So you can control the flow of water that comes out of it. And the fancier ones also have markings like you'd have on a graduated cylinder so that you can measure the amount of water and calculate how much the reaction's been completed. So the two questions I'll ask, which this is going to be thrown on top of that functional group question, is what would happen in this case? And separate, what would happen in this case? Similar questions. First is a carboxylic acid that's being treated with water, but a special kind of water, isotopically labeled water, O18, which means version of oxygen that has more neutrons on it. Very, very, very expensive stuff, but this is a good theoretical question. So I'll want an answer on that for Monday. This other one, I'm taking one ester and reacting it with an alcohol that's not the same alcohol that was already part of that ester. And the question is, what would happen in this case? You might get some hint to this one in just a moment, because now that I've spent the first half of the lecture on a cationic mechanism, I'm going to switch to an anionic one. But first, let me slip back into the hallway for a moment. Questions about this mechanism? Yes. Oh, no, that was all right. Now let's switch over to an anionic mechanism, saponification. Does anybody know what the word saponification is related to? Soap. Saponify, savon, sabon, you know, different pronunciations. It's related to soap. It's related to the old style way in which soap was made, where you would take lye, which is just this really basic caustic stuff, mix it together with animal fat, and that's kind of an oversimplified version, but that gives you carboxylate salts. Which, why is it that a carboxylate salt would be a soap in the first place? Now, I thought I remembered without looking. 16 carbon carboxylic acid that I'm now blanking on. I can't remember if it's palmitic or lauric acids or which one of the back of the shampoo bottle acids it is, but it's one of them. 16. It's either... I want to say it's steric is 18. Lauric? Lauric's smaller. If only we had these electronic devices that we can look these carboxylic acids up with. So if someone does that in the background, just for intellectual curiosity. But this is the common structure of something that you'd find in a soap. Why do these things work for cleaning up greasy stuff? And that's actually the point. They're good at cleaning up greasy, organic, compatible things. Why? Yes?
Because they have the ionic heads on the front and the organic heads at the carbon backbone. So they can dissolve the organic end in the grease part, and then just by stirring it up, the charge will separate the grease droplets and then thus clean the grease away.
Do you know the name of the structure that's formed in that process? A micelle. So you have an ionic head group, which to use biological terminology, we would say is hydrophilic or lipophobic, meaning water-loving or fat-hating. And why is it both of those? Because it is ionic. It is fully charged. The other end, we have the organic tail, which we would say is hydrophobic. It doesn't like water, but it is lipophilic. Fat compatible. If you get above a certain concentration, which is called the CMC, the critical micelle concentration, if you're above that, then you form the micelles, which are the structures in which the organic tails end up forming the interior of that body. And then you have the polar head groups that form the surface. So spherical in nature. That sphere dissolves in water macroscopically because the surface of it's ionic, but on the interior of it, it dissolves fats because the interior is lipophilic. And so when you drop, you got a nice greasy meal that you cook and you drop soap onto it, you'll notice even on the surface, because surface effects are often do these interesting things. Drop the soap on it, and it's like this ring radiates out very quickly. It's because it's forming these types of micelles. So that's why soap works. Soaps are often called surfactants as well, because they're surface acting. They do strange things at the boundary of phase layers like this. Now, getting back to the real story of the saponification reaction itself, it would look like this. You'd start out with an ester. Again, I'm going to default to my common example of ethyl acetate. And you'd use a concentrated solution of sodium hydroxide, and often you need to heat these reactions. This part of this reaction is reversible. Part of this reaction is irreversible. And you need to understand why for both of those, why part of it is reversible and what the significance of that is and why part of it is irreversible, because the behavior that we're modeling here, we're going to apply to other anionic reactions. For example, what would happen if we did a Grignard reaction with an ester? So we're going to get there, but first let's just talk about going back to carboxylic acid. Because notice our first reaction was take carboxylic acid, make an ester, and then we're taking the ester back to carboxylic acid. We'll then rapidly expand and talk about transforming between all the different functional groups, which what are the different carboxylic acid derivatives in descending order of reactivity? What's the most reactive? Acyl halide followed by, then, amide. For those of you who got here a little bit late, the notes are now posted from the first day, but even if you didn't have those, you did have the book, which even if you don't know what chapter it was, you knew it was carboxylic acids. Knowing that one of the questions on the quiz was likely going to be what the reactivity is, the difference between those functional groups, since didn't I give the big fat hint that that would be one of the questions? So if you already knew what one of the questions is, but you can't even tell me those groups in the reactivity order, then what are you going to be doing with these hints I give you? Right? Because you didn't have class Wednesday, so you had time to catch up, even if I was out of commission. Anyways, just a little to make sure that you all don't get behind at the beginning of the quarter any more than I've put you behind. Back to this. What's going to be the main reaction? What's going to be the only logical thing that happens first? SN2, which brings up this question of that tetrahedral intermediate, which is part of the reason I asked you about that oxygen 18. So I won't comment anymore on that intermediate for the moment, but let's say that it's not directly SN2, because remember that vinyl positions generally don't like to undergo SN2 because of repulsion of the electron cloud of the nucleophile by the double bond. But the carbonyl could be attacked, couldn't it? Why? Because hydroxide, that's a nucleophile, and you have a delta positively charged carbonyl, so you could push that open. Now, two compounds that we want to compare. Actually, let's make it three. What is the pKa of water? That is now added to the list of pKa's that you need to memorize on top of the aldehyde from the other day, which had a pKa of what? 16. And then the ketone that had a pKa of what? 19. Or did your class have that yet? Oh, now I'm being too mean. No, that was the other section that got a little extra love on Tuesday because even if I wasn't ill yesterday, I was going to have to have been absent from part of their class. So, since we're making out a chart, let me tell you that an aldehyde has a pKa of about 16, and that a ketone has a pKa of about 19. But more related to today's lecture, ethanol roughly has what pKa? 14. It actually turns out to be round about 16. Primary alcohols in general tend to have a higher pKa in solution than tertiaries. Reason why we'll discuss later because we'll get too far off track. But point I want to make is that if you deprotonate hydroxide versus ethanol versus t-butanol, the relative basicities of those ions are very similar to each other because their parent acids are very similar in acid strength. So, notice if we start with hydroxide, we end up with an alkoxide. But that alkoxide that I just said is probably not too different in basicity from the hydroxide that you started with. So that is a technically reversible step. Now, we're not used to that when we attack carbonyls, because in the past we attacked carbonyls with things like alkyl groups that are so darn basic that it's almost a completely forward reaction. Even if on paper we write a reversible arrow, it's so lopsided we didn't even discuss it last quarter. But now it comes up, especially when we're using carbonyl groups that have what could be called leaving groups. Because if that oxygen negative is not that much more basic than what we started with, well, yes, it could collapse and kick hydroxide back off, but by the same logic, it could also collapse and kick ethoxide off. Again, it not being much different in basicity than the other two things we've already played with here. So that step of the reaction is also technically reversible. But look what we just made. A carboxylic acid. You might say, well, duh, that's what you were setting us up for. But here's the important part. You also spit out this ethoxide, which is a base, which means there's an instantaneous neutralization that goes on. And that is, on paper, I guess we could write this as reversible, because all acid-base reactions are reversible. But recognize that the pKa of ethanol is 16, whereas the pKa of acetic acid is what? Round it up. What is it? 5. It is actually 4.76. So that's more than 10 orders of magnitude difference with ethanol, meaning it's so lopsided that we don't call it reversible anymore. We just say it neutralizes. So let me make two notations here. One by that alkoxide, and then one further down here where we just had that neutralization. So the initial portion of this saponification mechanism is technically reversible. Since the base used and the intermediate formed are similar enough to each other, in terms of basicity, I'm going to have a very similar sentence, but with the opposite outcome when we do switch to talking about Grignard reactions. Because a Grignard reaction, the mechanism will look very similar, but it won't be reversible because one base is so much more powerful than the other. Now, where this mechanism formally becomes irreversible is again at that neutralization. So at the end of the mechanism, both an acid and a base are produced. Which instantly neutralize each other and prevent the reaction from reversing. Which brings up an important point. For many of the reactions we're going to learn with carboxylic acid derivatives, there might be both an acid, a cationic version of that reaction, and a base anionic version of that reaction. But where carboxylic acids themselves are involved, sometimes that can't be true because the carboxylic acid is an acid. This is exactly one of those cases. We can take an ester and use a base to get back to a carboxylic acid. But with only one exception, we can't take a carboxylic acid and try to make an ester out of it. What I'm getting at is the following is possible. That we can do Fischer esterification. And it is the way that, not normally, one of the several common ways to make an ester. I'm hedging a bit because I'm about to show you, if we have time left, another common way to make esters that avoids the need for prolonged heating and acid catalysts. Because what if we're trying to do something where you already have some kind of sensitive functional group? But we can take ethanol and a carboxylic acid, heat them up with an acid catalyst, and successfully produce an ester. If we took a carboxylic acid and tried to do the basic equivalent, use sodium ethoxide, all that will happen is you'll neutralize. So esterification is not possible under basic conditions. Although I did say there's one exception to it, which is the reaction with the molecule diazomethane. Azo, a prefix some of you might recognize as having to do with nitrogen. So, let's see, diazomethane would be CH2 and triple bond N. Rather reactive molecule, particularly reactive molecule, explosively reactive molecule, so much so that you have to use special glassware. You have to use, I think it's plastic or plastic-coated glassware, because normal glassware has these little crevices that this gets into, and somehow that initiates the very explosion that you want to try to avoid. You might think, why in the world would you use such a compound? Because it's a beautifully clean reaction when it doesn't blow up that produces reproducibly and almost quantitatively, which means one mole in, one mole out, 1.00 mole is in, 1.00 moles out, 100% yield. It's a wonderful way of making a methyl ester, because here's the mechanism. Starting with a carboxylic acid, diazomethane is basic, as you might guess from the carbanion that we start with. If we react it with a carboxylic acid, that means we get this instant neutralization that I told you about. But then we have an unusual situation where we have nitrogen as a leaving group. Formation of nitrogen is an extraordinarily thermodynamically favorable process, which is why this compound's explosive to begin with. It just decomposes into nitrogen almost spontaneously. But once this protonations happen, you have an excellent leaving group on a primary, or not even primary, on a methyl position. And so even though carboxylate's not a strong base, you get an instant SN2 reaction, which gives you the methyl ester. So let me summarize what we've done the first 2 days in this unit of material. We've seen different carboxylic acid derivatives, and we talked about both why, in terms of induction and leaving group ability, there's a difference in the reactivity of those different derivatives. We've seen one of the prototypical examples of a cationic mechanism, Fischer sterification. We talked about how it is reversible and how we can influence that product distribution by using tricks of removing one of the products, in this case water, from that reaction. We've also now seen an anionic reaction where we talked about how base strength of what you start with and end with can influence the reactivity or the reversibility of that reaction. And we've now seen all the ways possible to convert an acid and ester back and forth to each other. Let me show you where we're going to be going next week with this so that once you've completed your studying of this much of the material, you can move ahead a bit. Because there are all these different reaction mechanisms coming. And let me just tell you, we're going to be studying hydrolysis, which means using water, heat, and time, and possibly acid, although we can talk about a base version. There's solvolysis, which is kind of the same thing, except using an alcohol, heat, and time. There's reduction, which is generally going to mean lithium aluminum hydride. Now we're going to care synthetically about lithium aluminum hydride versus sodium borohydride, which is not going to be reactive enough for most of these groups that we're going to be talking about this quarter. There is also alkylation, meaning Grignard, for example. And we're going to use all four of these mechanisms in theory on all the functional groups from this chapter. Acyl halides, esters, so on and so forth. Let me show you an example, a couple of examples, just really quickly, and then we'll be done for the day. Why are acyl halides useful? Because if you take an acyl halide and react it directly with an alcohol, so this is an example of solvolysis, acyl halide is reactive enough, you don't need an acid catalyst to get this reaction to occur. You'll very rapidly get the ester. So in principle, if we had something on the molecule that was an acid-sensitive functional group, realize that HCl is spit off as a byproduct of this reaction, so we'd want some kind of base scavenger thrown in, maybe something like pyridine, but it does avoid having to do the Fischer esterification. Question came up earlier about what would happen if we took an ester and did a Grignard reaction. Well, you did that last quarter. We already seen it. You took methyl or ethyl benzoate and reacted it with phenyl magnesium bromide, made a Grignard reagent. Keeping this generalized, after one Grignard reagent reacts, there'd be this opening of the carbonyl and collapsing, which I'll write out next week when we learn this properly. But that would generate a ketone, which means if you have any more Grignard reagent around, you're going to get a second addition, a double overall addition by Grignard reaction. So these are some of the types of things we'll get into next week. So you see the reactions that are coming, have an idea of what to study over the weekend. Are there any last questions before we go to the weekend? All right, now I do have the other section I have to go teach, so if you do have quick questions, they better be really super duper quick. Otherwise, I'll see you all on Monday.